management training. I'd hired a bunch of new people. I wanted them to feel comfortable. I didn't want them to be pushed out by the poltergeist at all, much less by harassment or an unwelcome environment. I had just gotten out of a situation where I felt harassed and unwelcomed, and that was the last thing I wanted my company to do. So I was sensitive to anything that might alienate people. I set aside time for us all to discuss what kind of culture the startup should have and how best to encourage it. It didn't seem fair to get people in trouble for something they didn't know was inappropriate, and had possibly been pressured to do, either. I wanted to be totally clear what was not okay and why, so that there would be no mystery and people would make the right choices. And I let everyone know that if, for example, a woman was being harassed, I would take personal responsibility for ending the harassment. I asked Frida to come talk about building inclusive cultures and to conduct mandatory anti-harassment and anti-discrimination training. She was no longer consulting. She was too busy running a foundation and was heavily involved in a venture fund and the nonprofit Level Playing Field Institute. But she offered to help as a favor. She suggested that she bring her husband, Mitch Kapor, as well. Mitch, as founder of Lotus and privacy-oriented nonprofit EFF, former board chair of Mozilla, and investor in many successful tech companies, had a lot of credibility. He had founder status and was great at connecting with the white male tech elite, because they saw him as successful and as one of them. At our all-hands meeting, the Kapors came in together and talked about their experience building a diverse and inclusive team and culture at Lotus, and discussed how we could do it at Reddit. As part of the training, Frida presented various carefully crafted scenarios and led conversations about whether the people in each situation behaved in a way that was appropriate or inappropriate, to what degree, and why. For example, one member of a team is African American. After months of working hard to make sure he underpromised and overdelivered to his team, his manager, and everyone around him, he seems to be increasingly part of the group. However, whenever the conversation includes racial relationships, he is asked for his opinion. Questions such as, "Why is Jesse Jackson harassing tech?" are directed at him. Some people thought the question criticizing Jesse Jackson was the worst part of the story. Others thought it was the asking of a question at all. A few didn't see any problem. The conversation was lively and prompted people to share stories of related things they'd experienced and to ask each other questions about what bothers them and what doesn't. I was proud of everyone for jumping in and sharing and learning. Well, almost everyone. One employee was very disruptive during the training. He was like a petulant child, sighing loudly and acting as if he were too good for the whole exercise. And he made his disapproval known in myriad and not particularly subtle ways. For instance, after a lunch discussion about taking down a phallic part of the graffiti art mural decorating the space, he wrote on the white paper tablecloth, so everyone at his table could see it, "Balls, balls, balls." After Frida and Mitch's session, a couple of women came to me and said they were so glad to have had that session. They explained, heartbreakingly, "I never knew before that this wasn't okay." They described various things that had been going on at Reddit for years. Others went to our HR person, who shared their stories with me. Ongoing harassment. Obscene recurring jokes. Inappropriate touching. All-male parties outside the office. A ridiculous number of messages to the team that included the word boobs. I began to think of myself as the new sheriff in town, and I made it clear to everyone that I wouldn't tolerate inappropriate behavior. One cause was the heavy drinking culture at Reddit. I found out months later that some employees, in the Salt Lake City office, ironically, had gotten one of the underage interns so drunk he wandered out of the office and through the streets in a daze. This wasn't fun and games. This was a matter of decency and of safety, and by the way of liability. I made a rule that there would be no events designed solely around getting drunk, and I banned hard alcohol in the office. We had been enabling people. Previously, I had seen a couple of transplanted employees go to our kitchen to drink glasses of straight vodka at noon and whiskey at 2 p.m. Under the new rule, we could go out to dinner or see a movie and drink at those events, but we couldn't get together just to get wasted. I was probably labeled a buzzkill for that decision, but I didn't care. I don't drink much, but I have nothing against drinking in principle. Ishan didn't drink much either, and our San Francisco office had a mellow, relaxed atmosphere. We had set up a bar stocked with hard alcohol, but most of the time people controlled themselves, and we had avoided the problems of the other offices. But some people on staff who were moving to San Francisco from other offices had shown that they weren't composed enough to have just a few martinis and still function. They were drinking like frat boys, acting recklessly, and, in the case of the underage employees, illegally. And many people had complained about how others had acted toward them at drunken work events. I heard one manager had been inviting all the men on his team, but none of the women, to drink at his apartment. I also made a rule that work events couldn't be all male. I found Kleiner's defense and encouragement of all-male events ridiculous, and I wasn't about to have Reddit fund or endorse the sexist practice. Women had been groped. Embarrassing things had been said. This was supposed to be a business. Drinking after work can be positive and fun, but the way it was happening there, at the time, wasn't bonding people together. It was tearing them apart. People were so horrified at certain people's behaviors that they started avoiding them. Some people were so embarrassed about their own behavior that they started avoiding everyone else. We had a lot of non-drinkers, including people who abstained for religious reasons, and I wondered how they felt during the alcohol-oriented events. We weren't alone as a company. The whole tech industry was trying to figure out how to deal with the problem. In February 2014, two women had launched Model View Culture, an online publication that took a critical look at tech and its practices, including the drinking culture. I subscribed to the print version immediately. When I met the publisher, I told her, "I'm saving a copy of every issue for my daughter to read 20 years from now so she can understand how bad it really was for all of us." I sat on a panel at a conference in Oakland with Dan Lyons, a journalist turned tech employee turned author of a book about ageism at his startup. When I shared how I had been compared to a rejected organ and cancer, he turned to me, flabbergasted, and related how he had been told the antibodies were rejecting him at his startup. He added that as a young white man, he had always unknowingly benefited from the system. But once he became older and the shoe was on the other foot, he was shocked to see how the system worked against him. At one point after my suit started getting press coverage, other women began to sue tech companies, with public filings. My lawyer Teresa Lawless represented a Taiwanese woman suing Facebook for discrimination. Her suit alleged that she was given menial tasks, like organizing social functions and serving drinks to the men on the team. Her manager questioned her for leaving her child to work and told her that she was not integrated into the team because she looks different and talks different than other team members. My other lawyer, Alan Axelrod's law firm, represented Whitney Wolf, one of the co-founders at Tinder, who sued for sexual harassment. The filing said the other co-founders sent her horrendously sexist, racist, and otherwise inappropriate comments, emails, and text messages, stripped her of her co-founder title, and called her a whore and a gold digger. I later met her in San Francisco, and she told me I had inspired her. She founded another startup and was thriving, which inspired me. Both of those suits settled. But others, against Microsoft and Twitter, are ongoing. Some reporters named the phenomenon of people suing or speaking up the POW effect. We weren't alone in Silicon Valley. Law school friends told me their New York law firm's biases. When I wrote in Lenny about my law firm sending a lawyer home for wearing pants, a former classmate told me that the federal judge she had clerked for after Harvard had made a snide comment about her wearing pants. And from then on, she only wore skirts to the courthouse. Another classmate talked about how she had refused to go to the strip club with a deal team of her co-workers and clients, and that they then treated her like a buzzkill. One woman told me how the general counsel she worked for at a public media company had sexually harassed her multiple times and was not reprimanded after she told HR, and how her career there stalled until she left. Hollywood stories started coming out as women shared their experiences there as well. Actress Jessica Chastain wrote about the similarities between Hollywood and Silicon Valley in The Hollywood Reporter. Ellen talks about sexism in the technology world and that it's so bad you don't even realize it's happening. People want to hire their friends and people they get along with. And if there is a company that has a lot of men, and the men are always hanging out together, those are the men who are going to be promoted. Jennifer Lawrence wrote, "Why do I make less than my male co-stars?" in Lenny in October 2015, after she found out she was paid 22% less than the male actors in American Hustle. She blamed herself and sexism for not negotiating harder. "I didn't want to seem difficult or spoiled. I'm over trying to find the adorable way to state my opinion and still be likable. F that. I don't think I've ever worked for a man in charge who spent time contemplating what angle he should use to have his voice heard. It's just heard." Women and men shared stories with me from academic institutions, private equity houses, investment banks, accounting firms, advertising agencies, the government, PR firms, big companies, small companies. The more I explored the topic, the more I realized what I'd experienced was near universal. That awareness made me feel simultaneously disheartened and convinced I had to keep my lawsuit going. During every free moment not at Reddit, with my family, recruiting, or on my computer, I was prepping for my trial. Every weekend, I would go to my lawyer's office or we'd get on the phone for long calls. I would check in with a lawyer friend frequently to make sure I wasn't missing anything. There was a lot to go through. My secret superpower of not needing a lot of sleep was called on every day of every week of every month I was CEO. We did the best we could with the resources we had. My lawyers, Teresa and Alan, were great. Teresa would have been a hippie if she hadn't been born and raised on the East Coast. Her mind was sharp. She could make connections and remember specifics of every detail, except names of people, which became a running joke. Sometimes I suspected she purposely mauled names to lighten the mood and give everyone a good laugh. She dressed in tailored designer outfits and always looked professional to the core. The only thing that gave a hint of her true hippie tendencies was her long and loose hair. She was also not afraid to joke with or push back at the judge or opposing counsel, and she didn't take anyone too seriously. Alan was just a super nice guy. He was a very precise and careful lawyer, but he had a humanity about him that was inspiring, even when I found his optimism toward the legal system frustrating. For instance, he said that potential jurors would not read the press and that the opposing counsel would share all the information through discovery. He was shocked to find out later that a juror had had lunch with reporters during the trial. He wore coordinated European outfits, even on the weekends. He expressed himself through his colorful patterned ties and coordinating pocket squares. He was almost ready to retire, and he saw this case as a nice bookend. The first time he garnered national attention on a case was the first major sex discrimination case, against one of the most powerful law firms in the United States, no less. And he had won an administrative assistant several $1 million at the end of it all. The associate lawyer, Michelle Lee, and the paralegal, Danielle Nicholson, on Alan's team were awesome. They worked hard and were committed to the case, and they tracked all the 700,000 documents without a problem on our antiquated technology, sometimes outdoing opposing counsel's army of lawyers and paralegals trying to manage their 5,000 documents. The jury selection consultant, Karen Jo Koonin, was protective and seemed genuinely interested in the case. She showed up at the trial a few times without charging, just to provide moral support. Our team dynamic was fun, supportive, passionate, and we collaborated easily. What's more, we had hard data on our side. Trey was very methodical in her interview with the investigator. She had collected data from all the investments in the firm and analyzed them. She showed, using both portfolio company book values and actual revenues, that women were doing a much better job as investors than the men at the firm, yet were not being promoted at the same rate. The men were inflating company values, when you looked at book values and revenues, but the women's investments were actually growing faster. I felt confident that we would prevail. But as much as I loved our team and our spirit, it was undeniably dinky compared to Kleiner's lineup. They had what appeared to be about 20 lawyers, that I knew of, arrayed against me, and two full-time publicists I saw every single day in court who did nothing but plant negative stories about me, and sometimes Buddy. I heard there were as many publicists working behind the scenes to do the same. On the front lines facing the jury, they had nearly a dozen mostly white, mostly women lawyers and paralegals, and at least two jury experts who worked on the trial full-time, not to mention $1 million-plus worth of expert witnesses. Behind the scenes were another dozen or so lawyers, mostly men, who had gotten the case to this point, pushing through different motions. I have no idea who was at the home office supporting all of them, but Alan and Teresa were sure there were even more unidentified people working on the case. Kleiner had far more money at its disposal than I did, and was spending many times more across the board. It was David against Goliath for us out of the gate. "I have never seen that kind of money spent on a single plaintiff," Teresa told me after the trial. "Kleiner spent more on experts than most defendants spend getting the whole case to trial. They hid their expert fees from the jury, and it just wasn't right. There is no way we would have lost if we had had their resources. That's why so few people sue. The money is not worth it, and neither is the bad press." It made a tremendous difference, too. For example, between my family and my full-time CEO job, I didn't have time to go through all my emails to figure out which ones to give Kleiner. So during the discovery process, we dutifully gave them practically everything, most of which we could have legally withheld. Kleiner had the time, the staff, and the money to go through hundreds of thousands of emails. I heard they hired a team in India to read and sort through every single one. Their work would show. During depositions, they brought up everything from my nanny's contract to an exercise I'd done in therapy where I listed resentments. Emails to friends, emails to my husband, emails to other family members, emails even to my lawyers. We didn't have time to review each of their 5,000 emails, much less our own emails. That's a regret I have now. I knew I'd made a mistake being so forthcoming when Kleiner's lawyers gave us less than 1% of what we gave them, claiming they didn't have the resources to search for anything other than emails that we specifically requested. My friend, a former litigation attorney, had warned me about this strategy, but Alan and I didn't have the time to figure out what to request, and our initial email search service provider was a disaster. Alan, the optimist, trusted that they would send relevant emails, and that they would keep privileged and protected emails out of the process. The whole jury selection process alternated between build-up and collapse. I'd be encouraged after hearing from several potential jurors who were perceptive and saw what was going on in the tech industry. Then the judge allowed Lynn Hermley to keep asking the same question over and over until every person who believed there was discrimination in tech got booted off the jury. If you said you thought there was bias, you were dismissed. I took notes on what people said that led to their dismissal from consideration. Jury candidate number one. "I work in tech, and many female friends have shared examples of misogyny and mistreatment, but I would like to think that I could put those feelings aside and be unbiased." Jury candidate number two. "I would say that I think there's systemically a problem with women being undervalued in the workforce. For a lot of women, it's a struggle to make the same level or to be paid fairly. Working in tech, women aren't necessarily treated well." Jury candidate number three. I'm a senior software engineer in tech. I tend to be the only woman in the room. And as a result, I feel like I have to claw my way to the top sometimes to actually get respect in a meeting. All three were released from jury consideration on the grounds that they were biased. That left, of course, only people who are biased toward there being no discrimination in tech. They were either not tuned in to the myriad of bias and discrimination issues in tech, or they knew about them and just didn't care. I left the jury selection process disheartened by the legal system, but still hopeful that we could convince the jury of the truth of the situation. To me, it was just so clear that I was right. As we geared up for the rapidly approaching trial, Alan and I would scan through documents to prep. Alan read aloud from the investigator's report describing his interview with Bing. "Ellen is like a tax attorney," he read. "She sucks all the air out of the room." It was a hit below the belt. While Juliet's turning on me was hurtful, I had been warned about her political and self-protective nature by many. Bing was the class clown, and he'd never said anything remotely like that to me in person. He had actually complimented me for lighting up the room a few times. We had friends in common, so we'd seen each other socially once in a while. I thought he was a bit of a kindred spirit, because he didn't quite fit in at Kleiner either. He was much older than the 26-year-old ideal worker, and people didn't tend to take him so seriously. They assumed his slow speech and jokester persona meant he was not smart or a threat. I always thought they underestimated him when they dismissed him as another one of John's hanger-on friends. His one big hit after co-founding Electronic Arts had been Zynga, which was a rocket ship of revenues and users for a long time, though in the end it was a mixed bag. Many of the people at Kleiner complained about the Zynga CEO and the culture of the company, which was run like one of its games. You would level up or level down every 6 months, when you were either promoted or demoted. Randy found the gamification offensive to his Buddhist aspirations. A tax attorney. At first, it stung. Did he really find me that boring? I found myself wistfully wondering what I could have done to make him like me more. But then the comment started to make me mad. For one thing, one of my best friends is a tax attorney. Daphna is funny and charismatic and super smart. But mainly I kept thinking, why would he go out of his way to call me that? Surely there was no question posed to him on the order of, is Ellen the life of the party or more like an air-sucking, life-draining tax attorney, would you say? No, he'd intentionally wanted to make a point about how I fit in, or didn't. That was the sort of news. He said this about you. She said that. I would hear routinely as the trial got closer. I would turn each new piece of information over in my head. As I pondered Bing's comment, I thought that maybe he was right. In that office, I was definitely a drag in certain ways. For instance, I didn't laugh at or encourage their bad jokes, like the ones about Indians in turbans or Black and Latinx urbanites stealing drugs. I didn't think all male events were appropriate, and I certainly didn't agree to check out the hot chicks at Rent the Runway or to share, what's your favorite type of girl? To those guys, I guess that's what I often was. A buzzkill. But the thing was, some people didn't find them fun either. From where I was sitting, I thought plenty of them sucked the air out of the room. In each meeting, my lawyers would encourage me to avoid showing emotion during the cross-examination, no matter how much the defense lawyer provoked me. Once we got to court, they said, I would need to offer only the minimum amount of information. I felt like I was training for a new kind of marathon, a kind of emotional staring contest. I would have to be made of steel, projecting calm and confidence. I would need to stay focused for days on end. It wasn't easy. I was repressing a lot of feelings. I was furious about how Kleiner had treated me and the other women, much less all the women and people of color who didn't even get a chance there. Since my miscarriage, I'd been carrying a weight of sadness and anger. I would not let them put someone else through what they had put me through. Just as I had after my father's death, I threw myself into my work. I was determined to make a difference as CEO of Reddit, which for me contained so much of the best and worst of humanity. I was convinced that we could rehabilitate the Reddit community by banning harassment and unauthorized nude photos, and by reducing flame wars, shitposting, and dogpiling, as well as by encouraging positive interactions, authentic conversations, and productive debates. Then no other internet site would have any excuses that it was just too hard for them to clean up their own communities. I was also determined to see my lawsuit against Kleiner through to the end. In both cases, my mantra was the Toni Morrison line. If you are free, you need to free somebody else. If you have some power, then your job is to empower somebody else. And I thought a lot about Alison Shefflin, who had sued Morgan Stanley for sex discrimination. At a press conference announcing the settlement for $12 million, Allison's sister had said about Allison, "Part of what kept her in the game was the feeling that if not her, then who?" The words, "if not me, then who?" echoed frequently in my mind. Who else would have both the financial resources to turn down millions of dollars in settlement, the emotional support from family and friends, and the relentlessness to defend herself against the leader of a powerful industry? Other expressions of encouragement came in waves. A woman in tech, Geisha Huss, emailed me her philosophy. "There is this saying that all positive comments we receive we deflect like Teflon, while negative comments we hang on to like Velcro. Realizing that we do this helped me focus on the people that deserved my energy. And I realized that we all have some shame and limiting beliefs even within us. And that is exactly why it's important we stand up, set examples. That's the only way this can change." No need to respond. I'm sure things are crazy. Just writing to you because you deserve to hear a billion times every day what an incredible person you are. Thank you for embracing your strength. I wrote her back that night. "Thank you for reaching out and for sharing such a positive and personal message with a stranger. One of the great things of this experience, one that outweighs all of the many difficulties and negatives, has been the connections I've made with strangers based on our shared experiences. It is really wonderful to be able to take something positive from all this. And I hope you will let me know when you are in SF so we can meet live. Thank you for listening, and for supporting and believing me." One woman, the aunt of an entrepreneur friend from Sunfire, convinced her nephew to make an introduction so she could take me to dinner to thank me. She was CEO of an impressive startup and had been CEO of another startup that got bought for a lot of money. She said she had been through plenty herself, and that poetry inspired her during the darkest days. She gave me a collection of poems by her favorite poet, Edna St. Vincent Millay. Whenever people reached out like this, I remembered why I was filing this suit. Women who confided such stories in me sometimes shared things they had never told anyone else, not even their husbands. They were embarrassed and ashamed and horrified, even if they'd never done anything improper. They had been trained to keep quiet, to just take on the blame and hold themselves responsible for others' actions. They'd thought they deserved bad treatment. "My lawsuit," they said, "proved that someone thought women deserved better. And it went beyond women." People from other underrepresented groups had similar experiences and reached out to me as well with their personal stories. The connections we formed armed me with confidence that I was on the right side. I tried to stay focused on what I loved about tech and to find ways to make it better for everyone. What I loved about Reddit were the awesome conversations. The site was so intriguing. Just people proposing topics and others commenting. Then voting the discussion up or down to help the good stuff float to the top and be easier for people to find. People would really hash things out with each other. I loved how at any given time you could go on there and get a snapshot of what was on people's minds. The sunlight shining through my cat's ear. Girl with Penguins, London Zoo, 1937. Tarantino's Cinematic Universe. Sawing a big water balloon. And the reach was phenomenal. When one Redditor posted a photo of a guy in a DeLorean taking a photo of a burning car on the freeway, the driver of the DeLorean responded by posting the photo he had taken of the burning car. One question asked on Reddit that I would often go back to when things got tough at work was, ex-neo-Nazis and racist skinheads of Reddit, what changed your mind? When and why did you leave? The answers were inspiring. Throwaway 08934. I was constantly in trouble for fighting and making trouble with other kids, and they were almost always black. I was a real shithead at that age. At 15, one of my friends was stabbed by a gang member, and I just felt angry and let down, blaming other minorities more than ever. When I got a bit older, and I was studying at college, not university, the 2 years before university is called college or sixth form in the UK, there were no other Eastern European people in my class. I was one of three white people, the other two being English, the rest being black or Muslim. I felt isolated until I was forced to sit next to a kid called Tristan, stereotypical South London, ghetto, black kid in every sense. He was involved in gangs, selling drugs, etc., and for the first week I didn't talk to him at all. But I realized that, actually, despite what I saw in him when I first met him, he seemed like a nice guy. So I started talking to him a bit. And I realized that all the shit I'd been through, getting caught up in violence, drugs, and everything else that came with being a young, poor, impressionable Polish immigrant, I could relate to him. Anyway, he became one of my best friends. And my 18th birthday was coming up, so I told him he should come along to it. Parents got some money together and hired out the top room of a pub near where I live. Well, you can imagine what happened. My attitudes had changed a bit, so I didn't think much of it at the time. But my old friend started getting violent towards him and his girlfriend who he'd brought. I saw all those people from a different light, and I haven't spoken to them since. I'm in my second year at university, and I'm still trying to kill any prejudgment of people that hangs over from how I used to think. If anything, the people I prejudge most are Eastern European. Throwaway for Good 12. I was sitting on the bus on my way home one day. I was listening to some good music in my headphones. It was a cloudless autumn day, and everything was a healthy yellow and orange color and blue sky. At a stop, an African man and a young boy, maybe 5-6 years, got on. The man was tall and had bad clothes. He looked like he did not have much. They sat in front of me. I immediately became annoyed and started to think about how I hated them. Effing immigrants coming to my country. He is poor and I pay taxes so he can get welfare. I thought about how his son is going to become a lousy shit and rape white women. I started to get mad and decided to beat him up. I was going to follow him when he got off the bus. I saw him press the button and got ready at the next stop. And just before we stopped, I was about to get up, and the man turned to his son and said something in a heavy accent that I will never forget in my life. "I love you, my son. Be good." He then gave him a big, hard hug, and the boy got off the bus alone. He waved goodbye and sat back down, with his hands on his face. I just stared out the window where his son had been standing. My worldview came crashing. He was just a father who wanted his son to be good. He loved him just like my father loved me. For some reason, this changed everything for me. I know this is a very small thing, but I started to think about how he wanted a better life for his son. He was a man that had changed everything for his family. I sat on that bus for hours. It kept going around. I thought about how wrong it was to do the things I had done, I left that city the next day and started over. I am much happier now. I don't feel the hate in my heart every day anymore. Thank you if you read this.
ERHYWERHWER5HW.
This story is difficult to share. I am typing this at the request of my son. I was raised as a racist. We lived in Southern California near a lot of minorities. My father was a union leader, and I think his hatred of minorities came from his job, because the union was mostly white guys and they saw the minorities as trying to take their jobs. Whenever we would drive around and see them in the street, my dad would always point them out and talk shit about them. I grew up and had kids of my own. I was doing the same thing to them without realizing it. One day I came home and caught my 14-year-old daughter screwing around with a black kid. I threw him out of my house and beat him in my driveway. The cops were called and I went to prison for assault. In prison, I saw how ethnically divided everything was. But my counselor was the one who basically shook me out of it. She helped me realize that continuing this hatred would really only hurt my own life. I tried to avoid the racial groups in my prison. I stayed on my own and earned my GED. In my classes, I met a lot of minorities who had also never graduated high school. I listened to my counselor. I got to know them and realized what a hard life they had. Before, I thought that they were just lazy and sold drugs for easy money. We went through a lot of the same struggles in our education. When I got out, I started a construction company. I make an effort to hire both former cons and also minorities. I am trying to make up for the kind of things I have done in the past.
You couldn't find these tough yet open conversations elsewhere. I still saw potential in Reddit, but there was trouble in paradise. In August 2014, nude photos of celebrities, Jennifer Lawrence, for one, had been stolen and posted online on Reddit and other sites. The pictures were illegally downloaded from their personal iCloud accounts, and the posting was partly intended to embarrass and humiliate them. I wanted no part of it, even though it drove tremendous traffic. As other sites quickly took down the photos and links to them, traffic to Reddit kept growing. Soon, Reddit was the only major site willing to link to the illegally obtained private pictures. I personally felt we had to take those pictures down. Not only because they were wrong, but also because the traffic to them kept shutting down the whole site. Eventually, our infrastructure engineer decided we could not keep the site up unless we took down the subreddit linking to the nude photos. After the shutdown, the site returned to normal. There was one more flurry of photos, and then it was over. Like many Reddit employees, I tolerated pockets of bad stuff on the site, because I believed most of the site contained good conversations and positive interactions, and we needed that freedom and laissez-faire nature mixed with anonymity and karma points to get people to share personal stories. But with CelebGate, the good stuff was being buried under the bad stuff, and our site was teeming with people looking for stolen nude photos. Some employees didn't like the thought of taking down anything, but others were relieved. They told me they'd been ashamed that the site had hosted those photos, that they'd had trouble defending the site to their families. I raised the question in a meeting. We love the site, because it creates conversations and connects people. Are we comfortable becoming 4chan? I was pretty certain the answer would be no. The bulletin board 4chan was famous for fostering harassment. On a no-holds-barred site without accounts, much less names, without permanence, and thus without any accountability. While there were a few people who wanted an anything-goes, free-speech-unlimited site like 4chan, most people agreed that some limits were necessary to protect the majority of users from abuse, and to protect the site's purpose of being a place where people could have conversations and debates. I talked to a lot of people, ranging from the founder of 4chan to the targets of Gamergate, to the leaders of Twitter, Snapchat, Facebook, and YouTube. Basically, I spoke with anyone who had a deep understanding of internet communities and or online harassment. The uniform message I heard was that the community needed slow, deliberate changes, consistently applied rules, and action over words. We would make mistakes, and we should be ready to fix them quickly. I decided that to remove anything from the site would require building internal consensus, and then doing everything slowly but surely, step by step, the right way. We had to be prepared for people to complain. We had to be consistent. We had to make it clear where the boundaries were. And we had to make sure our team was ready operationally and psychologically to enforce the boundaries. A couple of months later, as CEO, I was able to get everyone to come together around the idea that our first step in making the site's quality better would be to get rid of revenge porn and child porn. Jessica Moreno and I had spent hours together before deciding that this was the right first step. We would get an early win, test our team, test our technology, test our community, and then take a bigger step next. One employee told me about one of her sister's best friends, who'd committed suicide at age 16 because an ex-boyfriend had posted nude photos of her online. Harassment stories resonated with many on the team. We'd all seen, and many of us had also directly felt, the dire consequences of unbridled online harassment. Implementation of this new standard for photos would not be complicated, we determined. The site did not get many of these photos, and community members didn't actually post them. They linked to them. So we would only have to take down the links as people flagged them for us. I decided to take it a step further. We partnered with the sibling photo site that managed almost all the photos on Reddit, and they offered to take images down if they constituted revenge porn or child porn. The roughest part of the rule was, of course, that Reddit employees on the community team had to look at things that were flagged. All day long, they were seeing the worst of the internet. It was hard on them. I tried to make sure they knew how much they were valued. I hired someone to give them massages after a particularly bad day, and gave them time off when they needed it. I also empowered them to report child pornographers to the police. This was the one exception to our strong privacy values. Our privacy policy was very carefully crafted to be as protective as possible. Ishan had fought petitions for information about our users, and so did I. I even got our first privacy report researched, written, and published. Our staff wound up doing a lot of work educating law enforcement about innovations in online depravity. Once, the community team invited a couple of detectives to our office and tried to explain why we had called them. The detectives appeared to think we were wasting their time with silly, self-important internet ramblings. I stopped by to introduce myself to let them know that this was a CEO-level concern. They still didn't care. Finally, someone showed them the pictures and comments.
"Oh," one of the detectives said, blanching. "You're not just wasting our time. This is serious."
When we rolled out the new rules banning stolen nudes, child porn, and revenge porn, we knew there would likely be tremendous blowback. We approached it like going into battle or a product launch and prepared for worst-case scenarios. We set up a conference room as a war room, opened a bunch of chat channels, and tag-teamed the responses. We had prepared answers to every question we anticipated getting, and we talked through our position. We went through the site and deleted all links to the newly banned material. By the end of the day, there was no more revenge porn. We'd won. And in the end, there wasn't too much complaint about it. In fact, within weeks, we'd see other major sites, including Facebook, Twitter, Microsoft, and Google, follow our lead. I had always said, if Reddit can do it, others will be forced to follow. My only regret was that I had to miss a few hours of the battle. While my colleagues fought back the tidal wave of pornography, I was across town at the San Francisco courthouse.
Because on the same day we banned revenge porn, my trial began. Chapter 13. The Trial. When my taxi pulled up in front of the courthouse on the first day of my trial in February 2015, I felt none of the dread I'd anticipated. I felt, strangely, simultaneously eager and yet already a little tired. It had been nearly 3 years since I'd filed my suit. Those years had been filled with depositions, filings, jury selection, and all the preparation they involved, plus drama from battles over arbitration and even the attempt to disqualify one of my lawyers. My daughter had been a toddler when all this started. Now she was a bright, funny elementary school student. While the sense of injustice I'd had when it began wasn't as visceral, I now felt more clearly that I was justified in my complaint. The way my former Kleiner bosses, my so-called family, had relentlessly trashed Buddy and me in the press, and how its PR firm unleashed a troll farm against us, only made me more sure that the VC culture was corrupt and needed to be aired in a public forum. I was glad, in that moment, that I'd declined millions to settle, that I'd rejected offers to mediate, that my stubbornness had brought us here, to this bright morning at the San Francisco courthouse. As I entered the building, I noticed a pen of journalists and photographers waiting by the front door. I wondered which trial participant they were most interested in seeing. I walked past them into the building, looking around to see if I could spot the celebrity they were here for. I later learned that they'd been waiting there to take my picture as I entered the building but didn't recognize me. I guess I looked nondescript in my glasses, pants, and blazer, so they'd missed the shot. I took my seat at the front of the courtroom beside my lawyers. Across from us were members of the huge Kleiner team. I noticed that they had one black woman associate with them. In what seemed to me like bad management and terrible optics, she was seated by herself in the audience section, separated from the rest of her team by a short wooden wall, and charged with all the menial tasks, like getting witnesses bottles of water and carrying boxes of documents. The Kleiner attorneys called themselves the ladies' team. But there were still more men than women, as there seemed to be whenever big bucks are involved. Judge Harold Kahn struck his gavel. And so the trial, which would last 5 weeks, began. First, it was our turn to lay out the case. Alan Axelrod described me as being not unlike my male co-workers. Top colleges, science background. Then he said, Kleiner Perkins used Ellen Pao's talents for 6 years. When it came time to choose the next generation of leaders at Kleiner Perkins, Kleiner only chose men. In July 2011, Kleiner had failed to promote a slew of more qualified and experienced women, and instead promoted only more junior men. Alan described how my negative performance review toward the end of my time at Kleiner claimed that I was difficult to work with and too opinionated. While famously aggressive male colleagues were told they just needed to tone it down a little. He said we were making two primary claims. One, the deck was stacked against me because of my gender. And two, when I complained, I was retaliated against. And in 2012, fired. By the end of the opening statements, I was charged with energy. It was gratifying to hear it all spoken out loud, to have my side of the story come out, though it was somewhat limited and contorted by the legal system. I knew our case was strong, and Alan had done an excellent job presenting it. By this point, we'd shared a partial damages number, $16 million. That's conservatively what I would have made, we decided, if I'd been promoted when I thought I should have been. The difference in salary between my job and the senior partner job was the difference between about $600,000 and potentially $4 million or more a year. With Carrie, I thought, the number would be several times higher. $16 million would hurt them, but it wouldn't break them. After all, It was less than the $18 million I heard John had once loaned to another Kleiner partner. And $4 million less than Trey had asked for. And it was roughly what I suspected Ajit had received in severance, including Carrie. Then Kleiner's defense lawyer, Lynn Hermley, got up to give Kleiner's opening statement. She seemed to me like someone who had been beaten down too many times. She could no longer see any good in people and attacked without any sense of scale or humanity. At the end of one day of depositions, I noticed that she had a tear in her pants. I thought she would want to know about a 3-inch rip before going out in public, so I pointed it out to her. She glared at me as if I had physically torn the fabric myself. She ranted, 6 months after the article, about a reporter who dared to write about Lynn wearing a leopard print top. She openly complained about her team, criticizing them for all getting pregnant at the same time and wanting to take maternity leave. And Lynn bullied a reporter almost to tears by berating her in front of my team and some jurors about a cartoon her paper ran. Despite strict rules against communication between lawyers and jurors outside the courtroom. It wasn't a huge revelation when I heard that Lynn had once been so intense she'd made an opponent vomit in the courtroom. I would find her increasingly unpleasant and gratuitously vicious as the trial went on. But even on that first day, she was painting a black-and-white picture of me as talentless, stupid, and greedy. She accused me of not being a thought leader. She did not have the necessary skills for the job, the lawyer said of me. She did not even come close. I thought back on all my stellar job reviews. I thought about the groundbreaking views and ideas I had written up, including in op-eds for Time magazine and the Washington Post, which were good enough to run under John's byline. I thought about the TED talk I wrote with John that brought people to tears and moved one viewer to quit her job. I thought about my engineering, business, and law degrees. I thought about my ability to speak Mandarin and smooth out our relationships with our China partners. I thought about all the CEOs who said they enjoyed working with me. I thought about how John had written to other partners that it was hard to imagine anyone having a better year than I had in 2011. I'd made a huge amount of money for the firm, more than any other junior partner. I'd brought in some big winners. I'd given everything to the office and to John, working nights and days and weekends and holidays and vacations, including my honeymoon, for 7.5 years. I steeled myself for a month more of character assassination. Once the opening statements wrapped up and our first day in court was over, I went straight to the Reddit office. Everyone there was in a good mood because the revenge porn ban had been so well received. Our users weren't paying the ban too much attention. And in community management, no news is good news. I worked until the day was over before going home. When I walked into our apartment, Buddy hugged me for a long time, and then I went in to see our daughter as she slept. I knew I would miss more than a few bedtimes before the trial was over. I already knew it was worth it, but I hoped my daughter wouldn't suffer too much from my absence. As the first week of the trial went on, I watched several former Kleiner colleagues testify. Trey didn't decide that she would testify until the last few weeks before the trial. Eileen was an even more reluctant witness. Both Trey and Eileen were understandably measured in their testimony, careful not to be too negative. Trey was still working at Kleiner, and Eileen had just raised money from Kleiner Partners for her second investment fund. The CFO, who was also still at Kleiner, admitted that until 2012 the company didn't even have an HR department, and didn't provide employees with an anti-discrimination policy. They hadn't had one until Trey and I formally raised our concerns. There was confusion over whether there was an HR policy at all. While I was at Kleiner, our CFO had told me there wasn't one. But in court, she testified that it was in a locked drawer somewhere and couldn't be found. Some of the jurors seemed, rightly, I thought, baffled by all the inconsistencies. Randy Commissar took the stand sounding like a man with an axe to grind. He sold his version of events hard, sometimes pushing himself into a corner and still not backing off. At one point, Alan asked Randy, "And Mr. Chin had a challenge with his interaction with other employees. Isn't that correct?"
Randy said no.
I stifled a guffaw. Chihua was famously difficult to get along with. It was as though Alan had said, "The sky is blue, is it not?" And Randy had said, "Nope, never."
Alan got out the deposition notes and read from Randy's earlier statements.
Question. In Chihua's interactions with his Kleiner Perkins peers, did you think he had sharp elbows?
Answer. I would not have characterized it as sharp elbows, but he had a challenge. He was confident and sometimes could be perceived as arrogant.
Still, Randy wouldn't back down.
I see, he said.
Yes, I said he had a challenge, but I didn't say that he had necessarily a challenge the way that you stated, but yes, he had a challenge.
Alan pointed out that in his deposition, Randy had said that Trey had complained that Chihua was dismissive and arrogant. But Randy held fast to his portrait of me as a difficult outsider and of Chihua as a team player. There were other underhanded moments during his testimony. Randy had done something I found wholly inappropriate in the context of work. He had given me a book by Leonard Cohen with erotic naked drawings and poems about masturbation and other sexual acts. On Valentine's Day, no less. While Leonard Cohen is obviously a legend, receiving the lewd book from a coworker I didn't know well outside work felt creepy and wrong.
Business Insider called the book smutty and not safe for work after one look, adding, "In any normal workplace, a coworker giving such a gift would probably have been marched out by HR."
Years earlier, I had received a copy of Leonard Cohen's latest album from a BEA coworker and thought it was a lovely gift. We had talked about which songs we liked best and why. There was nothing about Randy's gift that I could talk about at work, and it made me so uncomfortable that I never discussed it with him, not even to thank him. He didn't bring it up with me either. Around the same time, he invited me to dinner on a Saturday night, explicitly noting that his wife would be out of town.
I said no.
When asked on the stand about the book, Randy laid it on thick for the jury, describing it as comparable to other gifts he had given.
"I can remember one year when I just picked up flowers for my wife, so I gave out single flowers from a bouquet that I had. I can remember once giving a picture of my rescue dog that one of the assistants really liked, with a heart on it from him to her."
I remembered my lawyer's admonition to keep my face blank, so I studiously refrained from rolling my eyes. Alan and Teresa did a fine job, I thought, pointing out the changes around the office after I complained about Ajit. Ajit was put on 5 boards in 2007. Trey and I were limited to 1 each by firm politics. And Alan showed how Ted seemed to abruptly turn on me in my performance reviews after I had disclosed Ajit's behavior. First, he read John's assessment of my 2011 performance. "I don't know how a junior partner could have a better year than Ellen did. Measuring results, profits, increase in value, except for her clash with Randy."
Ted disagreed.
"I think there are multiple facets of being a great junior partner, many of which we've talked about, which is the sourcing of new opportunities for other partners, just being a good partner to both your peers as well as your senior partners, the continuation of trying to become a domain expert, a lot of the areas that we've already covered, aside from how some of the portfolio companies might also be doing."
When the jurors had their turn to ask questions, one said, "In the performance reviews, it appears to have a lot of interpersonal and personality statements. Shouldn't the performance reviews be focused on the business and less on interpersonal and personality pros and cons?"
Exactly, I thought.
If the goalpost is always moving, how can anyone who's not buddies with her superiors expect to get ahead? And how do you get to be a buddy without invites to dinners, strip clubs, and ski trips? Also, are we focusing on making money for our investors, or are we just hanging out and calling it a day? Ted's testimony, while harsh,
wound up making me feel better. Anomalies in the reviews were finally cleared up. It turned out that Ted had set up a process designed to make me look bad. He started with the standard process. I was asked to list people I had worked with. Our outside consultant asked everyone on my list to review me. She organized their feedback and sent it to Ted. That, I found out, is when Ted went rogue. He solicited negative feedback from phantom reviewers. People I had not worked closely with that were not on my list and that he didn't list as reviewers in the final document. The "everyone hates you" negative feedback Ted had delivered to me was in fact from a board member crony of his and another venture capitalist I had not worked with much at all. It was a relief to hear that all my CEOs didn't think I was unhelpful. That in fact, the opposite appeared to be true. Finally, I heard the copious positive feedback that Ted had excluded from the review. I'd be lying if I said it wasn't a thrill to hear Ted reading aloud page after page of CEO's praise for me, and to hear him questioned about it. Alan. He said that she was very engaged and proactive. Correct? Ted. Yes. Question. And that she tries very hard to be helpful. Answer. Correct. Question. 100% behind the company? Answer. Yes. Question. Call her any time of day? Answer. Yes. Question. She is one of the three people I call from the board for her advice? Answer. Correct. Alan also went over feedback about me that Ted got from the experienced and powerful business leader Tom Ryder, a member of Amazon's board of directors and one-time president of American Express. Somehow this passage from Ted's notes hadn't made it into my performance review either. Took Tom under her wing and helped Tom learn about the company. Shared important insights. Her judgment was very accurate. Tension between board and management. Played important behind-the-scenes role. Would call Ellen for insights about team. I had been shocked to see how aggressively Kleiner had tampered with my performance review. I had known about Chihua from the HR consultant, but the others were news to me after I filed suit. Alan had Ted walk the jury through how he had replaced positive feedback from my original review with feedback from a slew of new reviewers that Ted had hand-selected, including Ajit, whom I had by that time accused of harassment, and Chihua, who had been told I tried to blackball him when he was trying to get a job at Kleiner. In the fake review I received, Ted opted not to list Chihua and Ajit as people who had contributed to my review, which made it look like their negative comments had been made by CEOs. Ted explained that junior partners were not always listed as reviewers. Wasn't Ajit a senior partner? Alan asked. Ted had to acknowledge that Ajit had been a senior partner for 3 or 4 years by that point. He never expected to be found out when he faked my reviews. I was supposed to believe them and disappear. In fact, if I hadn't sued, I would never have known. Kleiner's partners didn't even share the draft reviews in discovery, only the fake review. The outside consultant shared the drafts during her deposition. In his testimony, Chihua confirmed that he had organized various all-male outings, including a ski trip to Colorado. Ted had to testify about the plane ride where he and his drinking buddies talked about the Playboy mansion, a porn star, her X-rated cable show, how hot certain women were, and favorite types of prostitutes. And when Lynn tried to show that women did rise in Kleiner, we pointed out that nearly all the promotions of women she was touting had happened since I raised these issues. At the start of 2012, when Trey and I had formally complained, only one woman in the firm's 40-year history had ever been promoted to senior partner. The Kleiner partner's testimony was often rough for me. But at the same time, it was empowering to hear what I'd long suspected they thought, and how they went about validating and acting on those thoughts. It became clear that it was much more than just a couple of bad actors and a couple of random actions. When Ted was asked on the stand about how women were often seated at the back of the room, and men at the front in important meetings. He said, I really did not think it was a very big deal to us in who sits at a table or does not. Ellen is always sensitive to her status. I actually think this is a personality flaw of hers.
So much for leaning in.
When Mary Meeker, one of very few women to run a venture fund, testified for Kleiner, she was sunny as could be about everyone from John to Chihua. She even called me thoughtful. Though a juror's question did seem to give her a bit of pause. The juror asked, Because you are not a managing partner, did you think about leaving Kleiner Perkins? And Meeker said, Not because I'm not a managing partner, no. She made a big show of shaking my hand as she got off the stand. Teresa read the gesture as Mary's way of trying to look friendly to me. I said that was a nice way to look at it. But honestly, I would have preferred more on-the-stand acknowledgement that a lot of women had had a hard time in that workplace. Other moments were truly heartwarming. A 2007 letter from Eileen, my predecessor in the chief of staff job, was entered into evidence. An endorsement I didn't remember ever seeing before. On the personal side, Ellen has a dry sense of humor, a sharp wit, and a loyal, protective nature. People are still laughing about her holiday gag presentation from this past December, which is no small feat in our KP tradition. The most painful part of the trial, not surprisingly, was being cross-examined by Kleiner's lawyer. Lynn twisted everything I said, and the mischaracterizations she made were so intricate and so numerous that I didn't know how to even begin to correct the record without seeming belligerent. My older sister, who was attending the trial most days and who organized a friends and family tag team so I would never be without support in the audience, began calling Lynn evil. That lawyer, my sister said, has mastered that thing they tell you never to do in logic. She says things like, So you were in your apartment and you saw a cockroach and you killed the cockroach? And you were walking your dog after that? Then, after you killed your dog, what did you do? That was how I felt throughout the cross-examination. As a witness, you can't be too defensive. You can't interrupt. You can't correct everything because that makes you seem unfriendly and unlikable. You're limited in how many times you can say something like, Actually, that's not what I said, without coming across as too pedantic or too difficult. And I felt that Lynn knew that, and so she twisted the facts with impunity. She was constantly pivoting, making up statements, distracting jurors with unrelated misinformation, and overall building a false narrative. She couldn't ask a straight question because she was always trying to trip me up. At one point, she even claimed I'd never invested in a women's company. You've never done anything for women, have you? She said snidely. Again, I'd been instructed by my lawyers not to respond to comments like that, because it might open me up to more criticism. Jurors could find me difficult or aggressive. I had to let her direct the narrative, and I had to stay calm. I ended up coming across as distant, even a bit robotic, as I bit my tongue to keep my answers short and noncombative. But it hurt to leave that one unchallenged. It was patently false. If I'd been really allowed to answer, here is some of what I would have included. At Kleiner, I helped drive investments in 6 women founders, a meaningful fraction of the women founders we funded. A few months after I was fired by Kleiner, I had the opportunity to become an angel investor in Reddit, and I took it. And then I invested in 9 more companies. I found the experience liberating. I didn't have to run around building support the way I had at Kleiner. It was my own money. So I was able to do it old-school style. I went with people I respected and wanted to support. Of the 10 companies, 5 of them had women CEOs. Most of the other CEOs were immigrants. Only one was a U.S.-born white male. At Reddit, too, part of my goal was to create a scenario in which women and people of color, and people who were just different, could succeed. I had risked a huge amount of growth in traffic, something the board wouldn't necessarily be happy about,
because I wanted to protect women from having their private photos posted online by vengeful exes. And because I didn't believe it was right for the man who'd hacked Jennifer Lawrence's iCloud account to plaster her private pictures across the internet. I made my choices in hiring, company culture, and site standards based on what would be good for everyone, not just for the white men who were the early employees. And this trial was consuming hundreds of thousands of dollars of my own money, with no end in sight, risking even more if I lost, not to mention wreaking havoc on my reputation, my health, and my family life. Why was I doing it if not to make things better for women and other people Kleiner treated unfairly? I wanted to say so much to the jurors in that moment. But on my lawyer's advice, I kept my answers short and my emotions in check. Often I just sat there and said nothing as the defense lawyer went on and on with her vigorous attacks. I knew if I challenged her, the jury could interpret my pushback as confirming that I was difficult or aggressive. The press then portrayed me as icy, which lent some credence to the picture Kleiner and its witnesses were presenting, of someone who was